If you're a fan of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, I've got exciting news. I'm hosting a special event for recruitment business owners in London on September 17th and 18th, and I'd love you to join us. If you want to achieve your full potential, you need to surround yourself with the right people. At the Recruitment Coach Live Summit, you'll get to meet some of my podcast guests in person, hang out with us, and share ideas. Some of the folks I've interviewed on the show will either be attending or speaking at the summit. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit.
You talked about coming out of COVID in the IT market. It was crazy. Best year we've ever done. That was just amazing. You know, everyone, startups everywhere, everything was hiring, you know, perm fees coming out of our ears. It was amazing. But obviously, once that twisted and changed with, I'm calling it a tech slump, right? It was a terrible time for IT recruiters.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by David Bloxham.
I think about recruitment as a game. It is not a job. You know, it's fun. It's just a fun way to make money, and that's how I see it, and that's how I sell it.
David is the CEO of GCS Recruitment. With over 30 years' experience, David is passionate about connecting innovative tech companies with expert talent that drive their business forward.
For me, understanding that more corporate way that people go into accounts, the way they really become big businesses, is really by developing huge customer accounts and understanding, right, okay, if I'm into a customer, I want to be the number one supplier within this customer. I don't just want to do one or two deals a year. I want to do all the deals, right?
In 2017, you led a successful management buyout with Engage Talent, further cementing his leadership in the industry. Under his guidance, GCS Recruitment has expanded globally with a team of 100 consultants in 7 offices, including London, Reading, Amsterdam, Berlin, Dublin, Orlando, and Philadelphia.
I love that training people. I love taking someone that doesn't really understand it, and suddenly at some point they're like, oh, you take a client, you take a candidate, you put them together, they fall in love, walk off into the sunset, happy customers. You make money.
They also have their own podcast called GCS Connect Leaders. David, welcome. Thank you for being here.
I'm very excited to be here, Mark. I've been listening to you all week, so I'm a bit starstruck.
Okay, fantastic. this is going to be fun. We've been planning this for ages, and for various reasons, it's not happened. So I'm glad we're finally getting a chance to sit down together. So I always ask people, how did you get started in recruiting? Because I think it kind of is a nice way to set the scene.
Sure. Well, I talk about this quite a lot when I'm interviewing people. So, and I think like most people, I never really thought about a career in recruitment. I did French and English at university, partied quite hard during university. So didn't really know what I was going to do, but felt that I had sales skills. So I went for 2 jobs in Reading, which is where I went to university. One was selling printers, paying me £14,000 a year. One was selling people, paying me £8,000 a year. But I sat down with a guy that founded GCS, a guy called Chris Bartlett, and we talked about music for about 10, 15 minutes. And then he offered me a job, and I was like, this guy seems cool, so I'll give his a go. I hadn't got a clue what recruitment was, what IT was, to be honest. But it all kind of fell into place after a while.
That's hilarious. What attracted you about recruitment to accept the 8,000 a year base instead of the 14,000 a year base?
Well, what the 14,000 was selling printers, but I checked the commission, and I kind of worked out in my head that the value of the deals that we could do in recruitment versus the commission meant that I could earn more money in recruitment. I obviously didn't understand the difficulties of making those placements, but I just saw the upside more. So, yes. So yeah, I felt that, yeah, that seems, that there seems like there's more money in that. So let's go for that.
That's hilarious. What year was this, David?
1996.
Glorious okay.
Year,
all right.
Glorious year.
Yeah, so I started in 1997, and my first basic salary was £10,500.
Oh, you negotiated well there, Mark.
And then I was thrilled when I got bumped up to 12, and then 14, and then, you know, when I got to 18 or £20,000, I thought, wow, like I've really made it. But of course, it's all about the commission. Like I was, you know, doubling or tripling that in commission, but it seemed like, you know, like I was moving up in the world, so.
I know it's crazy, isn't it, when you think about prices and, you know, salary increases and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the things I'll talk about in quite a lot, the CEO of Engage talks about quite a lot, is productivity. And one of the things he's talked about quite a lot is recruitment productivity, and it doesn't really change from 96 to 2014. Everyone's kind of earning more money, salaries are higher, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But generally, he will look at a business and say, most, you've got 100 people, you're probably billing about 10 million. And that was the same in 96 versus 2024. The productivity, the efficiency of recruitment has not changed too much.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've often wondered about that because it doesn't seem like the targets have dramatically changed since I started in recruiting. I mean, they have a little bit, but not compared to the like inflationary increase in salaries and fees and all that sort of thing, which, yeah, I've always wondered about that. Why didn't the bar keep going up? But do you have any theories about that?
I think that, you know, I think that there's an amount of work that you can do. You know, there's an amount of placements that you can make as a human being. And I think that, you know, in IT, generally a good recruiter will probably do 2 to 3 placements a month. And that is, and if in a really, really good month, you might do 4 or 5, right? And I know you've sometimes talked about executive search guys, or sometimes you talk to volume guys. But in my world,
yeah, it's kind I of agree.
1 to 3,
yeah, you know, yeah. Sort of size deals. Two deals a month is kind of like
really good.
You're doing well,
and if you're doing that consistently, you do that through the year. And there's a lot of work that goes into that. In terms of, you know, finding the client, you know, even if you're in delivery, you're running against a project to find the candidate, to do the negotiation, the post-sale, the compliance, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it kind of, there's an amount of work you can do, and then you kind of get rewarded for that amount of work, and you can't really push that amount of work. So therefore, your productivity remains the same. But I think as well, within my industry, which is very competitive, probably margins have been battered down. So therefore, while salaries have risen, margins have come down, the amount of work that you can do remains the same. So what we're always looking for within Engage, and Engage is a really interesting business, is to try and increase that efficiency. And the way we look at that is how you create machines, how you create kind of people doing different types of work, splitting down the work of a recruiter. And that generally helps to mean that instead of like a team of 3 people could maybe, if they're more efficient, do 3 to 4 deals per month together between themselves. So it means they do 12 or 13 or 14, which means you can get more efficiency, which means you can get more profit, which means you can really kind of drive the business forward. So that's the idea. But I think one person sitting on their own in an area where margins are going down, it becomes very hard to continue to kind of rise with inflation, as it were.
Okay, let's dive into this. Straight off the bat, I'm fascinated by this concept because I think we all have this feeling, like anyone who's been in recruiting for a while has this kind of feeling like things are getting harder. Like it feels harder subjectively. And so you're working just as hard as you always have, but I don't know, for various reasons, the job feels harder. So when you talk about building machines,
you're telling me, Mark.
Yeah. So it's not just me.
I know exactly what you mean.
So the machines you're talking about, the efficiencies, could you go into more detail about that?
Sure. So I think, you know, I come from, and my team come from, and I just want to kind of put a bit of a shout out to the team that we've got, because they've kind of worked with me through the MBO and really, you know, helped people like kind of Lisa, Tim, Lawrence, and John out in the US. You know, these are really core people that have, you know, helped me through. And I know we're going to talk about the MBO some more, but we're all people that come from what I would class as a kind of an S3 kind of background. Not that we work for S3, but that computer futures, you own your desk, you're like your own limited company, you're a leader in your market, you spend your day calling people, finding contract jobs, filling contract jobs, and that's what you do. You know, that's how you do on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's really key. But I think that like when we talk about that productivity element, you know, there's only so far you can take that, you know. And since doing the MBO and since joining Engage, what we've understood is the guys that come and run Engage, people like Tim Cook, people like Adam Heron, they come from a background of larger corporates. So what we kind of start to understand, and I heard one of your guys, I think it was a guy from Three Search, saying he went from Michael Page to a boutique. I think for me, understanding that more corporate, like way that people go into accounts, the way they really become big businesses, is really by developing huge customer accounts. Yes. And understanding, right, okay, if I'm into a customer, I want to be the number one supplier within this customer. I don't just want to do one or two deals a year. I want to do all the deals, right?
Absolutely.
So how do you do that? Because one person can't do that. So therefore, you have to look at it, you know, if there are 100 jobs here within this company, then how are we going to set the team up so that we can fill 50 of them or 60 of them or 70 of them, you know? And own this company and own this customer and be the best supplier to the customer. So then that trickles down into, okay, so some of the people you need to be developing the accounts, some of the people who are salespeople, some of the people are 360 salespeople because they're the ones that kind of get you into the customers in the first place, right? We have a very strong cyber team. You know, cybersecurity is such a big thing at the moment. The cyber team are the ones that open the doors. But then you need people that are like, okay, the door's open. Now I need to go and speak to the other managers. But then you need account managers who are people that really understand and really control the delivery and control how we focus and bring things in. And then what we have developed at Engage and GCS is a lot of kind of offshore delivery centers. So people in South Africa, people in Dominican Republic, and people in India who are doing a lot of the candidate generation. So, you know, great people, generally better qualified in IT than I am, for sure. And they are generating the candidates. So we have this machine, and that's how you can go from being, okay, we do a couple of pieces of business there, a couple of pieces of business there, we're constantly selling, to kind of, we have this revenue stream that's coming from this customer because they love us. And that's the key thing, is to kind of make your customers love you, I think, Mark.
Awesome. All right. Thanks for breaking that down for us. So what would be a sort of, you've described sort of three different roles there. There's the kind of I don't want to say proper because they're all sales roles to some extent, but the person who's opening new accounts, and then you've got the account manager who is growing and developing those accounts, building the relationships, you know, increasing the footprint within those businesses and overseeing the delivery to those customers. And then you've got the sort of, I guess I would call it sourcers, people who are, you know, finding the candidates, feeding them internally to the account manager, who's then overseeing the delivery to the customer. Did I get that right? Okay. So what's the structure of that team in terms of numbers? Like, for every one account development person, like who comes behind that? Like, what's the structure of the support, the unit, like the basic unit within that team?
I think you can split it down third, third, third. You know,
okay, yeah.
You know, we talk quite a lot about onshore, offshore now. You know, we have kind of offshore teams, onshore teams. I try to get that mix, like kind of, probably 50-50 onshore offshore, or 60-40 onshore offshore. And then I think you could probably get it to, you know, 30-30-30. But as the market, and probably we're not in that market at the moment, but as the market increases, your customers get busier, then you can bring up the numbers of your offshore and your delivery teams, right? You don't need to necessarily always increase your sales teams, because they're bringing in these customers in. But, you know, as those customers get busier, they kind of, oh, actually, we've got really big projects kind of coming on, or we've won that, then you up the numbers that you can, that you have in your delivery team. So it fluctuates according to kind of market conditions, really.
Okay, fantastic. No, this is really interesting already. So when you say a machine, it's really a team who are working together to maximize the value for each of each account and make sure that we are the number one supplier with it, with that particular customer. I'd like to get into the weeds a little bit here,
sure.
Because one question I always get asked, David, and I've not come up with a 100% satisfactory answer yet, is when you have a split desk model like this.
Yep.
And so therefore, for every fee, there's multiple people involved in that placement. How do you award commission to everybody who is involved? Like, how does it break down? And I guess the thing is, in some times, like let's say 2021, 2022, finding the work wasn't as hard as delivering on the work, but then it flips. So like 2023, 2024, finding the work becomes incredibly difficult, and then filling the, you know, delivery is easier. So it's not like you can say, well, that is really the sales is more valuable than the delivery, because sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. So how do you figure out how to, you know, how to share the commission between all those different people?
Well, I think that to answer your first question, generally our salespeople are still 360, and they would work in quite focused markets. So, you know, our cyber team are incredibly focused around very core, you know, DevSecOps, IAM, PKI, cloud security. So that's the only thing they do, and they only do it in one location, and they do it on contract, let's say. So they're very specific, and I think that's where business rules come in quite a lot. You know, I talk a lot to, you know, I hear a lot of your podcasts, you know, where people are really talking about business rules. Get the business rules right. And then what comes out of that, then really what you've got to think about is a system of splits, or what we call person engagement. So it's kind of overrides on the kind of the business as you kind of bring it in. So that, you know, if you've opened up a major account, you think to yourself, right, I'm going to place like three or four people in this project, but I'm also going to open this up for GCS. And I think that comes into the culture quite a lot as well, that people feel like we're doing this together. And we talk a lot in GCS about this whole collaborative element of, you know, everyone has their role within the business, and that helps the business to grow. So that's where the rewards come in terms of opening those doors. Then you have your account managers that obviously are rewarded on the growth of the account, you know, so overall growth of the account, including working with the specialist salespeople. So if they pick up a role that's for a DevSecOps, and that would go back out to the specialist salespeople. So still they're winning from those accounts. And if I'm completely honest, like the offshore model, it has the same productivity, but it has 10% of the cost.
Right, of course, yeah.
So, you know, it's once you get it right, and it is important to get it right, you know, we work with some really strong partners in these locations who get some great people. I've tried it before in various different guises in the past, and it didn't work. You have to have the right people. Once you get that right, then that's a really strong basis for what you do. But you're right in saying that the market twists and changes. You know, and sometimes you're in the wrong space, you know, and you have to make very quick decisions. I don't necessarily think I've always made the quick decisions, and I definitely have never been very good at working out ahead of the game. So, yeah, you know, you talked about coming out of COVID in the IT market. It was crazy. You know, the best year we've ever done. I've listened to a few of your podcasts recently where people say, it was the guy, I think, who was talking about, you know, work really hard in the good times.
Yeah, yeah.
Brock. Don't work so hard in the bad times. I don't feel so good at don't work so hard in the bad times. It still seems to be working quite as hard. But anyway, that was just amazing. You know, everyone, startups everywhere, everything was hiring, you know, perm fees coming out of our ears. It was amazing, right? But obviously, once that twisted and changed with, I'm calling it a tech slump, right? It was a a terrible time for IT recruiters. You had to then think about, okay, we had some great accounts. They've maybe not so recruiting so much. And now we need to bring in more salespeople to open up more doors, to reintegrate with new accounts. And I think one of the things we've spoken about as well within the business is there's salespeople that are specialists. And then there's kind of salespeople that are customer focused in terms of account development. You know, they map out the customer, they think about the customer, they go to speak to every single person within the company, they develop partnerships, they do innovative things, they get themselves, they walk the halls, as we like to say. And those are a really key role. And it's also incredibly hard, I find, to hire, to understand, because it's such a weird role in recruitment, isn't it? You know, people just can't, like you just said about commissions, people can't get their heads around it. It's like, well, what are you doing? I can't see a fee against your name. So are you a real recruiter? And everyone's like, well, no, it is. Look, this guy is really important. But yeah, so we've struggled to kind of get the right people. We've got some great people doing that now.
So this maybe is a great segue into the idea of hiring, training, developing recruiters, because you've hired hundreds of people over the years, trained and developed people. What have you learned from having hired and trained so many recruiters, and how do you do it now?
Not that different to where I did it before. Okay. Mark, I love like teaching people about recruitment. I think it's great. You know, you're obviously a trainer yourself, as far as I know, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's just fantastic, isn't it? When people get the light bulb on, they're like, wow, okay, that sounds... I remember when I first did it and I picked out a phone to someone and they said, here's a job. I mean, my training that I got from GCS was like negligible. They said like desk phone, here you go.
Yeah.
Off you go.
Exactly. That's the way it was in those days.
I know. It's crazy. You didn't actually need to train them at all, or maybe you did. But I picked up the phone. The guy said, yes, I need someone. I found someone. I put them in. But then the person told me the job they left from the manager. So I called up the manager. And then he gave me a job, and then I found someone to put it in there. And that was in the first 2 weeks. And I was like, wow, this is like the easiest job I've ever done. And I remember I worked out the commission. So I was like, my God, I've just doubled, my salary was tiny, but just doubled my salary. Like, it's really easy. Then I was rubbish for the next 3 months. Like, didn't do anything.
Yeah,
so
as easy as it looks.
No, but I was really, I'm a very, very, if anyone has worked with me, I'm a very bad loser. So I was ready to throw myself out the window, and I was everything's against me. But then I kind of worked out and became quite good at my job. But I love that training people. I love taking someone that doesn't really understand it, and suddenly at some point they're like, oh, you take a client, you take a candidate, you put them together, they fall in love, walk off into the sunset, happy customers, you make money.
Let me pause right here, David, because what you just said is so important to any entrepreneur who wants to scale. You said, I love training people. I love seeing the light bulb come on. I love them doing their first deal and falling and getting that taste of success. And this is a mindset shift, I think, if you have ambitions to grow your business, that you have to make this shift and realize, guess what? You're a CEO, but you're also a trainer. You're also a coach. Like, that is a massively important part of your job. Now, when you get to a certain scale, you can hire or promote people to do that for you, like the learning development, all that stuff. But for a long time, you are going to be the primary trainer in your business. And you have to embrace that. And I talk to business owners who are like, oh, it's so hard to grow because then I have to train all these people. And that like distracts me from billing. And then a lot of them don't work out. And it just feels like a relentless, you know, hamster wheel trying to onboard these new people. And I think we need, now that is, that's one way of looking at it, but the way that you look at it is one that makes it much more likely that you're going to succeed at this.
and also it's fun, right?
Great.
It's just great fun. You know, you meet like lots of different people along the way. Some are really not very good. some are great, but so the first time I really did this, I mean, during my career, you know, I was the third employee of GCS. You know, I'm an intrapreneur, I think they call me. I wasn't the founder. Third employee of GCS, a guy called Chris Bartley, a guy called Martin Smith set it up. And I was obviously one of working with it. You know, I always say third employee. There was a few other people around, so it's probably about fifth, if you know what I mean. But I don't think about them too much. But we carry on, right? So growing up, learning recruitment, then they gave me a little team. So I had the team, that sort of thing. And then we got into the kind of fast track, and we were kind of one of those fast growing businesses, that sort of thing, based out of Reading. Reading was good for IT recruitment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At one point, it was kind of said to me, a little bit like we just talked about, like, who's going to do what within the management team? And we need to grow. So how are we going to bring the people on, right? And I felt that for various reasons, one, I quite like teaching people stuff. Maybe I could have been a teacher if I hadn't got a job as a recruiter. I quite like the systems. I'm quite organized. And people tell me that people quite like me, right? So I kind of like in the interviews and that sort of thing, you know, when you first like people kind of buy into it and buy into the dream, right? So, and you've got to have the dream. You know, there's no point doing this job. There's absolutely no point doing this job if you're not very good at it, you know? Because I say to people, and you could earn more money at McDonald's, I think. I actually worked it out that you could earn more money at McDonald's.
Wait a second. How so?
Think about the minimum wage now in the UK, right? And you're working a full-time job, that's about 20K a year, right?
Okay.
Starting salary for a recruiter, you know, 25 to 30. But yeah. Think of the hours.
Yeah,
you know, you don't get free McDonald's either. So anyway, I'm probably okay. Slightly wrong, right? But you know, I'm probably reversing Costa because you get nicer stuff. But so what I think is when I thought about it, when you think about bringing people in, then what you've got to think about is what's key in recruitment. You know, what's key to be a recruiter. And how are we going to set this up, and how are we going to make it fun, and how are we going to get everyone to do it together? I love having people together in an academy, you know, and they're all kind of bouncing off each other, all sharing nightmares, all sharing good days, having the competition, boards on the wall, that sort of thing. And this is what we're doing in 2004. So we didn't have all the tools and stuff that we've got now. But what I always think about the training is, number one, you know, it's insanely hard. When you and I started, Mark, although I just joked about it, it's quite easy, it's such like I just think people are amazed like how rude clients can be and how rude candidates could be. They're not getting any love. You don't get that in normal life, do you?
Yeah,
people are generally nice to you, generally, you know. But you call up a client, they just slam the phone down on you like, what's going on, how can this be? So you've got to help them through that, but you've got to kind of see the magic. You know, turn each call to your advantage. How do you, when you have those phone calls with people, you know, I call it communication with purpose. So every single time you're speaking to someone, and you know this, as a recruiter, you're kind of working out the conversation to make it so that you can get things out of it. We used to do a funny game in that we used to say, I'm going to tell you something you've got to say on the call, and it's going to be ridiculous. Right. So if yeah. You're doing the video, I've got like a butterfly in my back. Right. And I'm going to say, you've got to mention the fact that you've got a butterfly picture on your wall somehow on this conversation. And if someone can do that and switch it to say, start talking about butterflies or start talking about, you know, the fact they're going on holiday to X place next year, even if they're not or something, or something in the news, like we used to do it, a kind of bring out the newspaper and point to an article in the newspaper and say, right, you've got to mention that on the next call. Then they can control the conversation. And I think that's what recruiters do. So that magic bit, and then you just got to think about the activity. And then you kind of make it fun. Like then you make it competitive. And I love those little kind of internal friendly competitions that people are driving each other forward. And I've seen for myself, a lot of my senior management team, Lisa Forrester is a great example of someone that started with me in 2003 and is now my business partner, COO, But I've kind of seen her grow and grow and grow and grow over the years. But, you know, those that training that, and there's so many examples of people that I'm so proud to have worked with who are now either doing great things in GCS or doing great things, not for GCS, which makes me slightly sad, but there we go. But yeah, it's just great to see.
So a couple of things you said there that I'm taking away. One is the idea of, you know, training and developing people is fun, right? So that is a belief, right? When I do these interviews, David, I try and really understand the mindset of the person as well as the strategies and habits that have led to the success. And, you know, just think of the difference of a business owner who thinks training people is a drag and it's a distraction versus the business owner who thinks training people is fun. That, you know, think of the difference in the results that they're going to get with that difference in mindset. And the second thing I'm taking away is the idea of turning phone calls into a game. You're kind of gamifying it, right? By saying, well, first of all, there's the competitive element. Second of all, there's like introducing games like, let's mention this news article or let's mention the butterfly. And it takes away from like, I just have to grind out these calls and get the phone, get hung up on. And it shifts to, oh, okay. So how can I approach this conversation in a way that I'm achieving, you know, certain objectives, talking points, you know, and developing that skill, the conversational or communication skill that I can get someone engaged enough that we can have, you know, that wide-ranging conversation. So I love that. Any other insights that you've gleaned from hiring and training hundreds of recruiters?
Well, I think the last thing to say is, you know, over the years, we've trained, we've brought in learning development teams, growing the business, you know, moved the business, growing the business, you know, globally. One thing I would say is in the last couple of, last, you know, 12 months, you know, when we really said, right, we need to redevelop our sales team. You know, we've ridden on some amazing accounts for quite some time, you know, and some amazing markets. But I think we need to kind of go back to basics a little bit within our business. So I said, because I love it, you know, and we run quite lean. I was like, well, I reckon I'm in London quite a lot. I reckon I can do this. And also if we bring people in Dublin and in Orlando and different places, like I can do this on Teams now. And, you know, we can make this work globally, right? Virtually. And I hadn't done it. I mean, I hadn't done it really properly for kind of 10 years. And sometimes I kind of do stuff because I've got such a great team around me. I'm kind of, well, what should I do now? You know, what's good to focus on? But I felt this was really, really important. That, you know, properly important to you almost get back to basics. Like the stuff that you and I learned, Mark, when we first started in the late 90s, it hasn't changed, right? What you need to do is what I said, the client candidate thing, that's it. You need to connect people. But what I've learned since doing this is a couple of things. The fun, the enjoyment, the calls, the phone first attitude, the little competitions internally, all that sort of stuff. People's drive. You know, people talk about Gen Z and they don't care and all that sort of thing. They don't work so hard. Like they do. I just don't think they get the experience of it so much. But we've got some amazing new people in our business, right? But the difference is how bloody hard it is. You know, nobody answers the phone anymore, right? And that's if you're trying to call them. It's really hard to get through on receptions, you know. When you get into a business, the levels of compliance and the levels of, like, how am I going to get this job, you know? Like in the late 90s, me, in my first week, call someone up, say, have you got a job? Yes, I've got a job. Okay, cool, we're on. Right? That's how it worked. Now, it's just so much levels of complexity and MSPs and RPOs. And then, obviously, we work in international markets. And you think about IR35 and AUGs and bloody everything, right? It's so, I mean, we're mostly contract business, right? So there's a lot of compliance to do. But it's so tough to actually do the fun bit of the job. So I you know, I praise these people. They are working so hard to get and open up these things. But it's different because there's a lot more barriers, I think, to particularly
right.
contract recruitment.
So, David, how did you approach this subject then? So you wanted to re-energize and refresh the approach to sales development and new business. And so you did this across teams with, you know, your salespeople around the world. And like, what was the message? What was the approach? You mentioned getting back to basics, but then at the same time, you have to mention how much more difficult it is. So what did you come up with?
So I think firstly, we used to call it the Academy. Now we call it the Launchpad. That's just like, you know, names as it were. But the Launchpad meant that we were starting you off, which meant that it wasn't so much juniors with no experience. It was more maybe bringing in 1 to 2 years, 3 years experience consultants. But those people, they don't know how to sell. But one, they've been sat in their rooms in COVID, not really learning anything. Two, they've just been working on accounts, which were really big and gave them, but now they're like, oh, broken. So they kind of understand recruitment, but they don't understand how to actually find their own business. So we call it Launchpad just because we want it to be something that you feel this is really going to jet me off into a big career, right? We kind of play it a little bit like, oh, you get to work with the CEO. You know, I think people quite, oh, okay, because I've heard of GCS and I think they're quite big and you get to work with the CEO. So I mean, cool. You've met me now. So I've kind of, you can see that I'm quite passionate about it and I quite enjoy it. So it's not like I'm turning up in a bad mood about it. So that was the first thing. We kind of made it for slightly different people. There's so many more tools now. You've got Power BI, like you said, like, you know, you said it there, Mark, like gamifying. Like I think about recruitment as a game. It is a game. It is not a job. You know, it's fun. It's just a fun way to make money. And that's how I see it. And that's how I sell it. You know, I'd say
love it.
The first day is this is not a job. Now, as I told you, I'm a bad loser. So I'm playing Monopoly and I'm kicking the table over. And really for me, you know, that kind of element of using the tools around you, you know, there's so many great tools within the CRMs, within software, but I use Power BI a lot and like the different reports you can get out of Power BI linked into our CRM so that, you know, you can see live like what we're doing, how we're doing it and using different kind of tools. But then obviously now you can obviously be constantly training and bringing people together across the world to help global connections and help build that culture. Whereas before I could only really train someone in Reading or London and I had to go to Dublin to train them, but now they're all together, they're talking, they're on our Teams group, WhatsApp chats, you know, we use another tool called Rialto, that sort of stuff. So it's, you can get that communication, you can do prizes in different ways, that sort of thing. So I think using the technology and the tools makes it better. And then it goes back to, if you open this, right, if you get an opportunity, then we need senior people who know about compliance, know about MSPs, know about account development to help you. Because it's not like, I don't really need to help you do the recruitment anymore, like find the candidate. That's, I mean, you've got LinkedIn, we've got a fantastic CRM, we've got Daxtra, we've got all these things that kind of the candidate bit is probably easier than it used to be. But the bloody... Sorry to, well, bloody's not really swearing. Sorry, the bit of actually opening up the client, that's the hard bit. And that's where we really have needed people alongside them. So you treat them more like internal sales and then you bring in your sales manager to say, okay, well, let's agree the commercials. Let's understand the compliance. This is how we deliver these types of things. So I don't think you can leave people with 1 to 2 years experience to do that bit because it's really complex these days.
Wow, there's a lot to unpack there, David. First of all, because you mentioned tools, people are going to want to know what are the main tools that you guys use on a day-to-day basis?
Obviously, as much as it annoys me, LinkedIn Recruiter is a wonderful tool, but a very expensive one.
Yeah.
But fantastic. We use Lusha. We use Crunchbase. We use... Daxtra. You may have heard of Daxtra. It's kind of a search tool that we have within our own CRM to search back on the CRM. It's a kind of, you know, bespoke serum that we've got. And I use, we've got Power BI linked into all of our kind of KPIs. So I use Power BI a lot, and I get my kind of IT people, we have shared services, to tweak it so you can do different things with it. And I it's a great tool, Power BI. So all the stats, all the data, all the competitive elements are kind of coming to me straight away. So in terms of the training, that's what I use a lot. And then really what I try to do is to keep the communication going. Like, we're a Microsoft-based shop, so just keep the communication going on Teams all the time. Like calling people on Teams, talking people on Teams, arranging like calls on Teams between different parts of the world, and training on Teams all the time, like morning meetings on Teams. So you're constantly talking and talking and talking. And there's all those tools, but in the end, the best tool that you've got is your phone and you. So, yeah.
Do you want to just elaborate on that a little bit? I know in the prep for this call, you'd mentioned in your notes, like, what recruiters really do, and it's about phone and networking. So say more about that then.
There's a lot of chat about AI and tools and XXX, right? And that's, we know that we've had those chats along many years. Again, I heard it was the other guy, Perry, that I listened to, said, like, is one of his first clients, said, oh, you know about this internet thing, you're not going to be needed in 2 years or something.
Oh, yeah.
I told exactly. You, I've been listening to you all week, Mark.
That's awesome, yeah. that was Brock again, who said, that was his second day on the job. The HR lady said, oh, you know, this recruiters are done, right? That was 20 years ago.
This internet thing coming along. Yeah. So, okay, well, let's look at that.
So we, just to set the scene, we have started incorporating AI into all the aspects of our business and teaching our clients how to leverage it as well. Sure. I think it's a requirement now. So how do you reconcile the world that's changing so fast with the need to still, you mentioned telephone first.
Yeah. To me, phone first, right? I think that most of what we can do will be AI'd and could be AI'd and could be automated. And I'll give you a different type of example, right? So we work in, our main market is software engineers, right? That was coming up to 22, 23 was 47% of our business, right? In our record year. Spin that on 12 months, coding, right? Writing code is not such a dark art or a special thing anymore. And I do a lot of these podcasts all the time, like leader series with tech leaders, and they talk about the same thing. So AI has destroyed that market somewhat, right? Not entirely. And it's now about 19% of our revenue. So we've moved into areas such as cyber, you know, more embedded software engineers, you know, AI, et cetera, data, you know, that we've had to spin into different bits. Because the pivot, as Tim Cook would call it, because that particular area of the market has stopped, right? So that's just an example of what can be automated. A lot of what we can do can be automated.
Yeah.
You know, the searches could be automated. You know, the reach outs, the emails, the branding, the social media, the bloody training probably, you know, could be automated, right? But I don't believe what can be automated is picking up a phone and charming someone to making them think you're amazing at your job.
Absolutely. That is the final, like, for sure. I think in 2 years, 80% of what recruiters do, maybe 3 years, 80% of what recruiters do could be done by AI. But the human connection part, you can't really replace that. And understanding human motivation as well, like when you're talking to a candidate, and they say one thing, but reading between the lines, you're picking up something else from their tone of voice or the way they answer the question. And then being able to navigate the hiring process between two different parties who, I don't see how that part could be done by a machine.
When people are sending emails, when people are living on LinkedIn, social media, that sort of stuff, when they're doing that, they're doing something that can be automated. When they're picking up the phone and talking to people on the phone, they're doing something that, you know, the world would be very weird when that can be automated. You know, I think probably
I think
wrap
that
up
will
and
come, David. That's the thing.
Probably, like, you know. But so we try as much as possible to say, love these conversations, right? You know, gamify them, make them fun, make them see how you enjoy this. Pick up the phone, make phone calls, you know. This is how you do it. And obviously that links into Teams calls, you know, your Teams video chats, that sort of thing, because this is how you do it. But the other thing I always think about in recruitment is you're representing the client and you're representing the candidate. And this is why we interview based on passion, based on charisma, based on, you know, your communication skills, all that sort of thing, as well as if you don't really know about the hard work element, that sort of thing. Because when you speak to a client, basically what they're buying into is, I want you to represent me to these candidates out there. That's why I'm going to speak to you and not that one, right? Because, and the candidate's the same. Like, you seem good. You seem to be working with good clients, and I would like you to go and talk about me to those clients. So it's that element of you can only get that across. You can write a beautiful email. I can use Copilot to write a beautiful email tomorrow, right? But I can't use Copilot to make my phone calls better. Well, actually, I can, because it can tell me all the questions I can ask, but I'm going to be the one asking the questions. So we try to do that. And that's really where I kind of come to with what does a recruiter do? What a recruiter does is it has the human interaction, the human touch, right? And if we can really get that into the heads of recruiters, that this is where your value is, this is what you do, right? You meet people, you talk to people, you network, you find out things, you are there, you build your base and your platform and your network and your people, and they know you and they like you and they trust you, and that's what you do. And if you've got a million automated tools around you helping you to do it even better, happy days. But never forget that what your key part in this process is, and that's what we try to kind of get across with people at GCS.
Do you know, that's so important, David, because if recruiters are kind of retreating into, like, they're just sending emails, they're sending LinkedIn messages, they're scouring LinkedIn recruiter to find candidates, and it's all kind of messages going out, then they are replaceable by machines at some point in time, right? Whereas if you lean into the human element that you described, where you're connecting and consulting with clients and with candidates, then that's the part that is the most valuable, because that is difficult, if not impossible, to automate or get a machine to do. So if you wanted longevity in this business, then lean into the stuff that's hard, right? And develop your skills in those areas where only a human is going to succeed, because all the other stuff, like, it either can be offshored and eventually replaced by AI.
Only a recruiter, Mark, because most humans couldn't even do it. You know, that's our skill, you know? I have a love-hate relationship with other recruiters, because I'm very competitive as well. So I don't really ever like being in a room of recruiters, because, you know, that just annoys me. But in a room of recruiters, you've got so many charismatic, funny, excellent people. You know, when you listen to your podcast back, every single person, it's an easy conversation for you, right? It's there
for
an
sure.
easy audience.
I love
right?
my job. Like, this yeah. is, you know, and it's funny, David, you say you avoid rooms with other recruiters. I relish it, because I feel like these are my people and we have so much in common. And, like, I have met so many intelligent, you know, just driven, interesting people in this crazy business. And so, I love it.
I told you I'm a bad loser, though. So I don't like to hear other people's success stories. it's a certain skill that we have as recruiters. I think I go back to the fun element of it. You know, the best recruiters don't even see it as hard work. It's not hard work. You know, building a road, working on the roads, that's hard work, right? Working
in
the factory is hard work. This is, this is our job, right? We're talking to human beings, and it's fun.
Awesome. I like that reframe. David, I do want to ask you about the MBA because you were...
MBO, not MBA. I haven't done an MBA.
Sorry.
I'm applying for MBA.
Let me rephrase that. The MBO, management buyout. So you were one of the first handful of employees, and then you've been with the company for like your entire career. What drove that decision that, like, obviously you have a optimistic view of the future, right? If you're buying rather than selling, then you're thinking, okay, I'm going to take this and it's already a successful business and I'm going to grow it even further. So can you tell me what the MBO was all about?
An MBO is when you exit certain owners of the business backed by a company or an organization that has the money in order to do that, right? So GCS got up to an eight-figure kind of valuation. And there was no way I had that in my bank. To pay the founder. So we looked through the market. We decided this was a good time for an exit. I felt it was a good time for me to kind of really take the business forward. And with myself and my team, like I mentioned, we talked to a few people and we settled upon Engage. And the reason why we settled upon Engage, I don't know if you know of Tim and Adam. Do you know them much?
Really I know engaged? Of them. I don't know them personally. Yet.
Yeah, that's right. The difference between them and PE houses or investment companies or the bank is that they really, really know recruitment. So first question Tim Cook ever asked me, and this is a very kind of Tim Cook statement. There's no fluff. It was like, why should I buy your business? Straight away, bang. And I was like, wow, I'm in a proper businessman. and that was kind of pretty much how our kind of, they are, I call them like hard taskmasters. They really want you to work hard and work well, and then they will really back you with investment. So I really like that, in my world, I was like, I really like this attitude. So the MBO itself was a little bit like as hard work as an MBA, lots of long hours, preparing your business, really looking at your due diligence, really understanding what it's about, really focusing on the good bits. And what you understand really from an MBO is, from an investor's point of view, they look at like a business and they think there's so much stuff you do that doesn't make any money. There's so much stuff that's just waste. Like, why are you doing this stuff? Because it's hard. So sometimes when businesses look at things like spreadsheets and forget about the people, that's a bad thing, right? Because your culture is so important. But sometimes it's quite good because, like, you've got these divisions that don't make any money. Why are you doing this? Or it doesn't really help your brand or anything. So there's a lot of conversations like that along the way. We were able to kind of formulate a very good business that they and the private equity backers they've got are interested in. The other thing you learn on an MBO is make sure you hit your forecasts. Don't miss that. I think in privately owned businesses, if you say you're going to do £100,000 or £200,000 or £1 million or £10 million, and you miss it by 95%, no one really cares, do they? It doesn't really matter. You're still making money. In a private equity backed business, that is super, super important, because the PE firms are obviously interested in EBIT, are interested in reports, and you're interested in investment. So they have to know that you know your numbers intrinsically, what the contract number is going to be, what the perm number is going to be. Is it moving? Is it changing? There can be no surprises, and you need to come in within 2-3%. And we nearly lost the MBO because we nearly missed one forecast.
Wow. Okay.
And it was like, because you've got like, these are big, big business dudes at some point somewhere in like California saying yes or no, and they don't want to see that you don't know your numbers. So that's one thing I've learned, is knowing my numbers. But I think the key thing for me coming into Engage is they're very good in terms of keeping your brand. I was very proud of what we built with GCS. Love the team, love what we do. Don't want to change it. Don't want to become Engage Technology, particularly at the start. But what they're very good at is focusing you. So when I say we've got 100 people, and we've had more in the past, that's all recruiters. right? There's no back office there. It's all shared services in Engage, and they provide a fantastic, efficient service for us. And it's very cost effective. So we're very profitable now, much more profitable than we were as a standalone business. But they allow you to focus, right? And they will test you in board meetings when you're saying we could do this. I've had managers or boards before where they don't push back so much. They don't make it so hard, you know, and sometimes I guess some people don't like that because they want an easy ride. But for me, I find it quite challenging and useful to have people that are kind of, you know, kicking the tires of your ideas and not saying always nice stuff. And I don't think that's right. And you're like, oh, you know, one time Tim, I think, or Adam said to me, he's like, you've got to say these things three times before we'll say yes, because basically you've got to refine your arguments until we know you really believe, you know, so you really believe in it. And I've always sort of kind of held with that, and I kind of do that with my people as well now, and kind of keep saying it back, keep saying it back until you really, really believe it. You've really got it kind of perfectly in your mind. So for me, like the investment we had, the growth that we've had, the backup that we've had to move into different locations and work in, you know, do like German contract or Dutch contract or, you know, US work permits or something like that. That's really helped us to grow the business. But the most exciting thing about the MBO for me, and I talk about kind of, you know, Lisa and Tim were the two people that are kind of still with us that joined it. But we moved from being kind of employees to shareholders, to people that could run the business and make those decisions within the business. And for me, that's so exciting, so important to do. And as I brought other people, like other senior members of the team kind of forward, and we've got John who runs the US for us now, Lawrence who runs cyber for us, and we've got different people as well, like Stacey and Ryan. And as we move these people forward, you know, I think they have a lot more buy-in to the fact that they can make these decisions within the business, which I really love. And that's what Engage allows us to do. So while you're backed by a strong, big corporate business, I think there's about 1,000, 1,200 people in Engage now. So a huge business, that you still feel like you've got a strong ability to make decisions and move yourself forward. And that's what we've done. And it's been a great experience, if challenging. And challenging times as well. So, yeah.
It's really cool and interesting because when I talk to founders or shareholders of recruiting businesses about, you know, getting investment from private equity, then it's kind of a mixed bag. Some have had, like, it sounds like your experience has been positive, and then others have been less so. And, so what do you think makes the difference there between whether it works or it doesn't work?
Well, I think I know for a fact that I didn't make a lot of money in the deal, right? And so therefore, I'm still very, very motivated. I do feel like, you know, if you make money in the deal, and I have seen it, then your motivation levels, you're waiting for the earnout, right? I am definitely not waiting for the earnout. I am on the ride. So I think that's important. You know, if you're making investments, make sure you don't just pay someone so much money they walk. You know, my founder, you know, my original business, Chris Bartlett, you know, he's done very well, you know. He's moved forward, and he's had a happy kind of ending to his GCS career. He's retired now, right? And I respect him, and I love the fact that that's the case. So I think that's one thing. You know, if you're being invested in, or if you're investing in, just make sure that the people that are still running the business aren't so rich that they just don't care anymore.
Okay, noted.
The second thing is, I think kind of give, you know, what Engage do is they give people, you know, really, really, you know, you're in a corporate structure, but they call it the corporate entrepreneur. So I still feel that I run GCS. You know, I still feel we have our culture. And I still feel that, you know, I make the decisions in a board with investors and their business partners as well, that we take the business forward. So I don't feel I've lost GCS, you know. But I also think the type of person I am, in terms of, I quite like that corporate structure. I like the fact that we walk into a big office with lots of people and, you know, there's other things going on. And I told you I don't like being in the room with recruiters, but if they're on my side, then I quite like them. So yeah, it's great to see other CEOs share information, you know, go to kind of engage board meetings, different types of training. And you just learn so much. I've learned so much from different types of people kind of coming into the business. So I think that's really good as well. There's lots of good people in the business that really help you to build your business and grow your business and learn stuff.
Do you think it's important that your PE firm focuses in the recruitment sector so that they have that expertise and also then you're part of a wider network where you learn from the other entrepreneurs?
100%. You know, the people that run Engage are backed by PE, but they are recruiters first and foremost. Like, they've run big corporate businesses. I also spoke to PE firms who were interested in our business, similar sorts of money, but I just felt like, well, what are you, other than money, what are you going to give me? You know, and probably they would have brought in NEDs and NEDs or whatever. But I just felt these guys, you know, were as committed as I was towards the goal of growing GCS. And that was what I really wanted. And they could give me stuff, knowledge, experience, networks that could help me to do it.
David, thank you so much for sharing your extensive experience and insights. It's been a lot of fun. Is there anything we haven't covered that you wanted to make sure that we touched on?
All I would say, Mark, is that we're doing our own podcast as well, which is GCS Leaders Series. I hope you have a listen to a few of those, Mark. I don't know if you've listened to any of those, but
I will do, and we'll include a link to the in the show notes. But what's it called if people are searching for it?
So it's GCS Leaders Series or GCS Connect Leaders Series. We've done about 80 episodes now.
Wow, that's awesome!
Yeah,
and is real. You're committed.
Yeah, and it's talking to leaders in technology. So we don't talk to recruiters. We talk to, you know, managers and leaders within the technology space. And there's some really interesting conversations there. I personally use it, again, because I find it quite fun, but to build relationships and do
exactly
something that helps me to understand the market that I'm in. So yeah, if anyone is interested in listening that is a technology leader, wants to be involved, then please reach out to me. And if you want to find out more about technology leaders, then have a listen.
Awesome. And we'll also point people to your website in case people are interested in careers with GCS as well. So, David, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mark.
All right. I look forward to talking again. And we should compare notes on the podcast side of things as well and see how we can learn from each other there.
Fantastic. Yours is much more successful than mine. So I'm only going to get tips from you, my friend.
80 episodes is, you're a proper podcaster when you've got 80 episodes for sure. All right. Have a great day, David. Take
Cheers.
Care.